All right. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you're listening from around the world. Welcome to Women in Environmental Science. I'm Srini Anantapuntla, and I have Dr. King Lan T with me here today. Thank you so much for coming to the podcast, Dr. T.
Well, thank you, Saranya, for having me today, and I'm very excited to speak to you.
Absolutely. Same here. So, to get us started, could you elaborate more on who you are, where you're from, and what work you're currently doing?
So I am an assistant professor in the Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering at the University of Sheffield in UK. So I work in the area of biomanufacturing. Specifically, we look at how we can develop more sustainable manufacturing processes as well as products for everybody. Yeah.
Gotcha. So like what kinds of products do you design?
Oh, okay. Let me see where to start here. So I am in my career, actually. I actually started working very early on during my postgrad studies to look at enzymes. So at that point of time, we were looking at how, for example, enzymes can be used to develop bioprocesses to replace existing chemical processes in order to make it more sustainable, for example, using less energy, producing less toxic chemicals. Mm-hmm. So this was actually at the very beginning. And I must say, because when I did my undergraduate in chemical engineering, so when I went into biotech, it was quite an interesting transition because I started to realize a lot of new things and learn about how, for example, biological systems that can actually be applied. And I guess one of the things which I still remember right now is it was really at that point of time I realized, oh, that I have actually enzymes in my laundry detergent to remove my stains from clothes. So I thought that was quite interesting. And from then on, actually, we do develop enzymes, for example, for detergents, also to develop enzymes for production of biopharmaceuticals. So these are actually products which can be actually produced in biomanufacturing and to help to deliver a more sustainable product. The other thing, actually, for example, right now, we are actually looking at how to produce bioplastics as an alternative to our fossil-based plastics, as well as to use biomanufacturing processes in order to develop production of alternative proteins, which can help us to actually improve our food systems and make it more sustainable.
Gotcha. Yeah, what you said about like using enzymes to do the same processes as chemicals would usually do. But make it more sustainable is very like, we need that now. And it's really important, really, really current. Actually, like one of the research things I'm doing is with algal blooms and like harmful algal blooms. So like treating them with algicides, and algicides are just like really toxic chemicals. They kill both the algae and all the microscopic life. Well, depending on which ones you use, like for example, copper sulfate does that. But like we found that instead of using, copper sulfate to kill the algae, if you use the zooplankton that are in the water, you just make sure that they are alive and really abundant. They themselves will kill the algae for you. And you don't have to use like a chemical process that probably won't even last long. So it's just, I love that. We see parallels in what we're doing.
I think what you say is really interesting because, to be honest, there's two sides of a coin to everything, essentially. Yeah. If you talk about algae, a lot of people are looking at algae as a resources to use it as feedstock for production of different things and even biodiesel, for instance. So while we see, let's say, algae bloom, it is indeed a problem in many places, but essentially, it depends at the end of the day how we treat it. Like you say, there are different ways of treating it and also how we use it. What we see as a waste may actually eventually be a resource for us.
Exactly. That's true. The context of algae I'm talking about is like aquaculture, although in that area you can use like biofuel, but right now the algae biofuel isn't that prominent in aquaculture farms. So like they need some sort of way to kill the algae so their fish don't die. So you also talked about like bioplastics. And I just want to, what are bioplastics? Like, how do you make them?
It's quite a broad topic, I would say. So bioplastics, I think from a basic understanding of it is that it is essentially plastics that are made using bioresources. Mm-hmm. So for example, when I say bioresources, I mean starch, lignocellulose, or even algae, for instance, that you're talking about. And traditionally, or even now, actually more than 99% of our plastics actually come from fossil fuel. And that is how we have been producing it for, I would say, since 1950s and even right now. So in terms of bioplastics, the difference is that instead of using fossil fuel, we use actually bioresources, which is more renewable. Mm-hmm. But even the term bioplastic itself, it's quite broad because there are many different types of bioplastics, just as there are many different types of plastics itself. And when we talk about bioplastics, there are actually also different ways of producing them. So for instance, some bioplastics are produced using bioresources are used to produce the monomers in some plastics. Mm-hmm. And then the monomers are actually polymerized using chemical processes to produce the polymer. But there are other processes whereby the bioresource is directly utilized by the bacteria, for instance, and the bioplastics or the polymer is directly produced inside the bacteria. So in a sense, these two differs in that the second one actually directly convert the feedstock into polymer within the bacteria, whereby the other one is kind of a two-stage process. So this is, I guess, the type of bioplastics actually that we are seeing on the market right now.
Yeah. Gotcha. So like how are these cost effective? So like we use plastics because they're, you know, really cheap and easy to use. Is that the same with bioplastics?
That is actually a really good question because there are a lot of ongoing development in bioplastics. And I think one of the need for that is because of cost, which you've mentioned. I think if you think about it, for the last 50, 60 years, we have been producing plastics using chemical means. Mm-hmm. And over time, you can imagine we've gotten really good at that. We got really good at producing it such that we can produce it cheaply, how to process our feedstock cheaply. And the whole process actually brings the cost of fossil-based plastic really down, and such that it is, you will see every day even for single-use packaging in supermarkets. But bioplastic itself, it's, while the nature of bioplastic is not new, so it's been known for a long time now that we can produce bioplastics, the development of it into a real, let's say, industrial process is something that really happened in the last 10 years has taken flight. Mm-hmm. And one of the key challenges, exactly as you mentioned, about the cost of bioplastic itself. And in a sense, that is also linked to the sustainability of bioplastics, because there are a few costs, there are a few areas in the production of bioplastic that's costly. One of it is actually the feedstock itself. So if we are actually using the, starch for production of bioplastic, the feedstock itself is costly. So costly in the sense that essentially we are using something which can be used as a food for production. I think this argument is very similar to what we've seen in the past on biofuel. So whereby you have the food and where the food versus fuel competition. In this case, it's similar. And also, it's not just about cost itself, because production of, let's say, crops actually, when we actually harvest crops for the use of bioplastic production, we also have to consider factors whereby in cultivation, we use a lot of fertilizer, a lot of pesticides, you need land, you need water. So the process itself, we are using limited resources in the sense of water and land, but at the same time, we are also using fertilizers, for instance, is actually very energy intensive to produce, and it is actually very costly in terms of the environmental impact. So I think from the perspective of bioplastics, there is a need to actually make it more cost efficient. And one of the ways to do that is actually to switch into more organic waste material, such that we can reduce the cost of the production itself. And also, if you think about production as a whole process, upstream you have your feedstock, so you want to go for cheaper feedstock and more sustainable feedstock. In the middle, you kind of have the micro product, the production itself. So how do you increase the productivity, the yield, and it becomes quite an engineering problem here. And then downstream of it, how do you extract it efficiently such that you can actually have process whereby it is efficient, but as well cost effective, and of course, not toxic to the environment. So it's really quite a large spectrum of optimization, if you will put it, that needs to be done. And each part of it requires slightly different expertise, because from process, obviously, chemical engineers are very good at looking at processes, at optimizing them, how do you put things together, heat integration. From the production itself, whereby we use biological microbes, for instance, to do the production, there are actually many different ways these days to improve the performance of microbes, to make them produce more products, to allow the yield to be higher, to do the fermentation differently. So, I guess I went on and on, didn't I? But to cut the story short, essentially cost is a factor, and there are actually a lot of development these days looking at how we can actually improve that. We still have some way to go, but I think the beginnings, we have seen the beginnings of companies starting to commercialize their bioplastics, and I think this is actually a good sign that the industry actually is progressing in that direction.
Yeah, I think it's great because like bioplastics are kind of new and up and coming. We've got some way to go with them, right? We're like you mentioned, we've had so much time to really get plastics to be the best that they are like today. But with bioplastics, we just need to give it a little bit more time, but we'll definitely get to that same level. I totally believe that. Mm-hmm. So like, what is there any environmental effect of the bioplastics on the environment, or is that completely negated?
I will say that it's completely negated, at least. Oh, this is actually a very difficult question to answer, partly because of the number of variations of plastics that we are looking at, as well as the different ways that we are producing them. But I think one thing we have to look at is in terms of looking at the impact of environment, there are a few things, and it's not just about consumers using the plastic and then discarding it. And we see a lot of news about plastic pollution. We understand that we have actually been using plastics for the last 50, 60, 70 years. A lot of it is ending up in our ocean. So all this has become very clear. But in looking at the impact of environment, it's not just about the consumer and plastic waste. It's really also about how we are actually producing it. That has an environmental impact as well. And on top of that, how we are actually managing the end of life of the plastic waste. For instance, in looking at environment, as I mentioned earlier about how we actually produce them, type of crop that we use, the material that we are using in terms of feedstock, does have different environmental impact. The way actually we are using them, of course, how we actually discard them, and can we actually reduce single use, this has environmental impact as well. And in the sense of the end of life, certainly, while even if, let's say, it has actually been shown that, of course, if you use bioplastic itself, there is less CO2 emission because of the fact that you are using a renewable resource.
Right.
But then again, how do we balance that against, for instance, the CO2 emission that we are actually producing because we are using fertilizer in crops? So that is actually, well, to be honest, there's a huge group of scientists working on this itself, whereby they try to look at like life cycle assessment of plastic production, plastic utilization, and what processes or what are the key things that's important actually for actually making it more environmentally friendly or more sustainable in the long run. But I think at least at this point of time, I think that there are still many questions that needs to be answered in terms of are bioplastics more environmentally friendly. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, I think that it can be environmentally, it can be better, I believe it will be better for the environment, but there are actually many questions that we need to answer. And the first being feedstock, second being producing them in, let's say, a sustainable way. And really, finally, the other thing is that it really doesn't, I mean, no matter what, whether it's fossil-based plastic or bio-based plastic, we are actually using resources to produce them. If we actually use it for 1 minute and then we discard it, it is really not resource efficient, because we are essentially throwing away a lot of resources when we have only used them for a short period of time. So I think the circularity of the system, which is something I think a lot of people talk about in terms of circular economy, the circularity of our system is important. And actually, this is also one of the things that we try to look at, in a sense, can we actually recycle? Even if it's bioplastics, it is good to recycle the waste material. For instance, there are actually enzymes, to come back to enzymes again, there are enzymes which are known now that you can actually use to break down plastics. And bioplastics is the same. There are enzymes that can break down bioplastics. Can we actually depolymerize them and use them as a feedstock for production of new plastic, for production of other materials? So I think this part of the work would in the future become very important in terms of its environmental impact of plastic, because being able to reutilize the resource from waste material is actually, I believe, a very important step towards our responsibility for our environment and making the way we live much more sustainable.
Yeah, I mean, you're totally right. It's something we don't really think about, but you know, so let's take a car, for example. Whenever we drive the car, we emit CO2 and other gases, but the production of that car also emitted CO2. Like the mining of the resources for that car also emits CO2. So yeah. It's just like this cycle. That's probably why the CO2 problem is really hard to fix, because at each stage of the production of a product or doing an activity, you're releasing CO2. So it's just... It's like, how do we even fix that?
I think you're absolutely right. That it's quite, if you think about it, it's mind-boggling, because there's so many factors that you have to consider. But thank goodness we have colleagues out there, scientists out there looking into this problem.
Yeah, thank God there's not one person who has to do it all. Thank God. That would be scary. So another thing we talked about is like eliminating the use of single-use plastics in the first place. I mean, I think that makes so much more sense than just like throwing it away right after we use them. So do you think that like the best solution would just be to eliminate trash cans and just you either recycle or you bio or decompose them?
I think it's, well, in the ideal world, every time we use, let's say, a plastic, if we really have to discard it after 1 minute, which ideally we don't have to, but if we have to, it will directly go into some place whereby it can be reutilized. But I think this point that you brought up is actually very critical and actually very difficult to achieve, because essentially we need the right infrastructure to do that. So the infrastructure has to be in place whereby not only do we need to have, factories that can sort out the right type of plastics, we then need this plastic to be able to be reused or broken down and then use it as a feedstock for something else. And from a consumer perspective, this is interesting, because sometimes in some cities, people try to put as many trash cans as possible, because our government council try to put as many trash cans as possible because they want that people have a place to dispose their garbage. So there are situations whereby, let's say, people for security reasons try to reduce trash cans in certain buildings or on certain streets. But what they find is that they just get more garbage on the street. So that might not help. But I think this has a lot to do, not just about technology, but really infrastructure is a huge question here. So not only do we need to develop technology that allow us to actually to recycle it, because to be honest, in terms of recycling, there is a lot of scope to improve in terms of innovation there. Because a lot of our, let's say, plastic waste, are mixed together with other ways. Mm-hmm. Sorting is actually a huge question about how do we sort out the right waste material for us to recycle or for us to repurpose them. And there are a lot of people looking at how you can use technology to sort this. And of course, there are also countries whereby there are actually some countries are really good at waste segregation. Mm-hmm. So for example, I believe in Japan, their waste segregation system is very clear, whereby each household really separate specific plastic waste, specific. So the system is very clear about how it should be segregated. And I think from this perspective, the education is very important. Mm-hmm. I mean, even let's say within my house, I recognize that I want to recycle, but sometimes it remains still to this day unclear for me. Does this particular waste go into this specific bin? So I think from that perspective, that relates to infrastructure as well. How do you set up the right infrastructure for people to use? And how do you set up the right infrastructure to direct the right type of waste into the, let's say, a right industry or the right recycling plant? And how do you set up the innovation in the recycling plant such that you are able to repurpose or even add value to the waste that you get?
Gotcha. So really it's the education part we're missing out on. If we had the right knowledge, this goes here, like they have in Japan, we can probably, you know, reduce like our trash waste, because there's a lot of people who want to recycle, like you mentioned, but they just don't know how, because there's so many different ways you can go about doing it. And if you mess up, it kind of messes it up. So I guess
it's really a combination of education, innovation, infrastructure. So it's probably right that it kind of needs the contribution of every single person who's using it. And that's everybody essentially. Yeah.
Exactly. And another thing, just like I was going to ask you about how if enzymes were able to like break down plastic, and that's a thing now. That's crazy. So now we have like, we can have bacteria that might be able to break this down and, like you said, repurpose the plastic. So is that like happening in the oceans right now? Like the plastics we have in the oceans, are there bacteria that are just like chomping away on the plastic?
I think right now in nature, probably not. If we look a bit into the background of how the bacteria that can actually chomp up plastic, like you say. So plastic is something actually quite modern, if you think about it. It's actually invented in the, I think, really commercialized in the 1950s, very much after the World War II, I think. So hence, in terms of material, in terms of as a product, it is actually very modern in the history of, let's say, nature. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the enzymes and the bacteria that you're talking about, whereby they can actually chomp up plastics and try to break them down, they actually, I believe, come about because of the fact that plastic become a sort of persistence in our environment. So we all talk about evolution, as in the Darwin's theory of evolution says organisms that can survive this environment are fittest in terms of they will be able to survive in survival of the fittest, essentially. So a lot of these microorganisms that actually can chomp up plastics, they are actually found in the plastic waste plant, for instance, or plastic collection centers, whereby because the largest resource they have is plastic there, so they actually then evolve for mechanisms to use that. So while I have not actually looked into, let's say, plastic chomping microorganisms in the sea, but I would imagine that plastics in the sea is also a very modern thing. And as well as the fact that while there are a lot in terms of concentration, it is still limited, whereby compared to, let's say, a plastic recycling plant, you actually have a lot of plastic within a very small, in a very small location. So it became the most accessible feedstock, or most accessible nutrients for the bacteria, whereby in the sea it is different. But I suppose in the modern era, whereby synthetic biology is such is such a powerful tool these days, it is possible that we might be able to engineer a microbe that actually can, let's say, degrade the plastics in the sea into, let's say, harmless material in order to remove them from our ocean. So I definitely think there is a possibility to do that. But of course, there are many things involved in the sense that we always have to be aware that if we are actually engineering a microorganism, if it is going to go into the environment, not only do we have to look at its benefits, we also have to be careful about what are the implications involved there.
Right. Introducing anything to the environment is a little scary because you really don't know what's going to happen until it happens.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So kind of pivoting to your entrepreneurship work, like I think it is very cool that you've got like your PhD in biochemical engineering, but like instead of following the usual path, you know, you're using that biochemical engineering degree to do like entrepreneurship and have I think you've got two companies, right, with two startups. Uh-huh. So how was the thought process of that like? And if you want to elaborate more on the startups, that would be great.
Well, I must say that when I was studying, put it this way, I didn't really set out to be entrepreneurial and things, but I also wouldn't say that I really took a very different route compared to other people. It's just that I have always been quite interested in seeing how science can be converted to everyday products and how it can be applied to solve everyday challenges. So when I kind of moved slightly between chemical engineering to biochemical engineering and to what I'm doing now, I think this perpetuates whereby I constantly see, oh, if we can do this for this, that would be great. And this can be applied to improve things. So I think the entrepreneur or the motivation actually to go in this direction is really more about personal interest, whereby I really like the applied area of science itself. So I think from the perspective of a researcher, I always felt that it is important to appreciate what we do in the lab, not just about running the experiments, seeing what we get results from, but really to see the broader and recognize the broader impact that it can deliver. And for that, I quite like reading news articles, magazines. I find that that's really, sometimes I think that is perhaps where it triggers or inspire me to do things, because in a lot of, especially scientific magazines, they actually talked about different types of challenges and what are the problems, what are the new innovation. And I think every little thing helps in terms of developing new ideas and seeing actually the application of your science. So I actually started, for my first company called CSAM Biotech, that was actually quite some years ago. And at that point of time, actually, I was working a lot in protein engineering, so directed evolution specifically. And following after I graduated, we actually see this as a very useful technology that can be used for many, many different industries. So then we wanted to use this as a platform technology to help different industries, be it, let's say, enzyme companies or companies or chemical companies, to actually develop the right enzymes for their processes. So that was really the process, I would say the thought process behind that. And we had a technology which actually can allow us to do that very efficiently. And hence that was, I think, more recently, in fact, actually beginning of this year, we actually started a company called Evoluta Limited. Mm-hmm. So what actually Evoluta does is that, kind of in the last 2-3 years, we developed a platform technology again, whereby it allowed us, instead of enzymes this time, we actually look at strains, so microbes essentially. Because if you think about manufacturing processes itself, when you run a fermentation, if you want to produce any product, the efficiency of your microbe defines your output. So how much product it can produce, how fast it actually grow, and can it actually work in the environment that you want it to work? So this is actually I would say a central problem or a central challenge for any industry that tries to use a microorganism to produce their product.
Mm-hmm.
So drawing actually from evolution, we actually have been working on, let's say, using evolution techniques to improve strains. And with that, we actually built, an automated system that allow us to evolve strain in an automatic manner. And that is actually what we actually use as a platform to start our company Evoluta. And that is where it can now be actually applied or used for biofuel industry, for food manufacturing, for chemical industry. Mm-hmm. So we try to work with, in fact, we work with different types of industries to look at how we can improve their strains. Yeah.
Gotcha. So yeah, I mean, like, just seeing startups with biochemical engineering is just something I haven't seen personally, but I totally understand. Like, that's really cool that we're like applying the science we're using in the lab, mm-hmm. and then taking it over to the products. Yeah. So I wanted to ask, like, how important is interdisciplinariness in the work that you're doing?
I would like to say very. Okay, so I think by the nature of how I actually developed my career, in the sense that starting from really a very engineering background, whereby I look at distillation, look at heat transfer, heat integration, to reaction engineering, and then following that, I started to look into DNA, protein, how to design them. So I think the nature of how it developed actually is quite interdisciplinary itself. And I think that has actually helped me to, broaden my perspective in terms of how I actually look at challenges and how, consequently, how I source for solutions for them. And I think interdisciplinary, it's actually a very important thing these days. For example, I work in bioplastics. So this is one of my active area of research. But if you think about it itself, I cannot really work in silo, because even if I can develop strains that can produce bioplastics to very good yield, even if I can engineer the strain to produce different type of bioplastics, I do need to work with, on my upstream, people who work with feedstock, such mm-hmm. that we can see what are the useful feedstocks to actually apply to my process. And I also work with people who are developing material. For example, after I produce the bioplastic, it isn't of any use if it just sits in my lab. So I have to work with chemists who are actually more experts in developing material to make it or to apply it into different types of application, to add, for example, even to mix it with different additives to give it actually smart properties. These are actually some of the different things that can be done. And certainly, I think it is important to be aware of the nature of the interdisciplinary nature of this work. But at the same time, it is also important to recognize that you cannot do it on your own, mm-hmm. because not many people can be an expert in everything. So it is actually important to see that you need to either build a team around you to deliver the type of work that you're doing, especially actually if I go back into entrepreneurship. When you are setting up a company, you really need different expertise in order to bring it from idea into a reality. Similarly, in terms of research, you do need this broad expertise from different people, and in order to actually develop a product that can really be used, let's say, on the market.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So you need everybody. Just can't have one person doing it.
Yeah.
For sure. I think environmental science as a whole is interdisciplinary in itself. Like, you can't study air pollution without studying psychology of the people whose air is getting polluted. And mm-hmm. you need policy in order to like make those changes. So just like you really do need that, like, well-rounded enough, but also like precise enough that you know what you're doing, and but still have those like not that knowledge and other connections.
Yeah, I think you are actually, you're absolutely right there, because the thing that you mentioned about policy, so we cannot neglect the importance of having the right policy to actually promote or to encourage the development of different fields. For example, even in terms of plastics itself, having the right policy to encourage the innovations, or putting the right focus on the innovation that can help bioplastics become a reality, but also the incentives for, or even regulations for companies to actually start to look into using bioplastics as an alternative for their products. So all this really needs the right policy to encourage this movement.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And like, pivoting a little bit to a bit more about you and your background. So you've worked at multiple countries like Germany, China, and now the UK. So what have you learned from these areas in regards to like culture, their research methods, and just like character in general?
Maybe first of all, I really enjoy actually working in different countries. And I must say, I have been very lucky to get opportunity to do that. So I think the experience for me is that it's great for character building and personal development, because you get to see and experience so many different things. So maybe first off, I would really encourage anybody who's looking to do that to just go for it, because it is really a great experience. I think in terms of working in different countries, From science itself, that means doing research, I don't think it is that dissimilar. So because whether it's a research lab in UK, Germany, China, or even Thailand, where I worked in 2019, I think the objective is they are similar. Mm-hmm. And the training itself may be slightly different. But then again, if you study biochemistry, it's the same in UK, it will be the same in China or Thailand. If you look at biotechnology, we will also largely look at the same type of methods that people are using.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, touching on this point, I think credit really goes to a lot of open access resources in terms of scientific literature. I think that really helps everybody to become more engaged in the innovation and to understand and develop from, to understand what are the things that's available and develop from there. And perhaps from research perspective, the difference could be that the availability and the access to resources may not be the same in each country. So some country may have, for example, more equipment because they have more resources to buy more kits, but in other countries that might be less. However, I think this gap has also reduced significantly in the last years. I mean, when I was in Thailand in 2012, I actually worked there for about 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the lab is well equipped. And it isn't really very different from what I see, for example, when I am in UK. So there are well-equipped labs everywhere. Mm-hmm. But one, that's something that's quite interesting that I noticed is working in UK, I guess we kind of pampered to some point of to some extent, because if I want to order a chemical, I order it, it arrives in the next 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
If I work somewhere else, it could be possible that you look for a chemical, it takes you weeks for it to arrive. So I think these are really the difference in terms of the infrastructure available, the accessibility to resources and chemicals, whereby mm-hmm. it will be different for each country. But I think beyond that, research itself is very similar everywhere, because you always work with people mm-hmm. and you always work with whatever you have, whether it's chemicals, enzymes done in your lab. So I think that is similar. The real difference really lies in, I would say, maybe culture and people, because naturally they are different. I mean, we are all different, coming from different parts of the world, and culture to some extent is shaped by history, is shaped by our religion. So every country, for everybody, it will be different. And in turn, culture shapes the people, their habits, and the environment also shape the people. So there is a inherent diversity in terms of working, whether in UK, Germany, China, Thailand, they're all different.
Mm-hmm.
I think this diversity will definitely persist despite globalization and everything. Maybe it might make it less obvious, but I do not think it is something that will go away. But then again, I don't think we should let it go away because I think diversity is good. I think diversity is good. And on a very personal level, I find that it is very interesting to interact with people from different countries, to work with them, because it is both fun in terms of seeing how different things are done. It is also very educational to see how people in different countries are celebrating their festivals, eating their type of food. And in fact, if you talk about environment, actually the views, perspective of how, of the environmental impact, I would say in different countries, different people have people have different perspectives about how our human activities are affecting mm-hmm. environmental impact. I mean, some countries have more, I would say, public engagement in terms of this type of activity, and people tend to become more informed. But at the same time, it is actually a very challenging topic, because just if you talk about plastic, for instance, we know that we want to reduce plastic. And however, in some countries, cheap plastics that can be used in, let's say, single-use plastic are very important for the livelihood of some of the people.
Mm-hmm.
If you visit countries whereby, let's say, they have street vendors, the way street vendors sell their food is to put it in a single-use plastic and then they give it to their customer. So if, let's say, we impose policies whereby we want to significantly reduce single-use plastic or remove plastic even, the livelihood of these people would be affected. So for example, while I'm here, we talked about different alternatives, how we can actually have policies to reduce plastic use, but it does have, when you go to a different country, different type of implication. So mm-hmm. I think an environment itself is important, and certainly we must strive towards living more responsibly and consuming in a more sustainable manner. But there is really no one size fits all when you look at different countries and really impose or apply policies into even environmental policies to different countries as well.
Right.
But I think from people's perspective, actually diversity helps to bring more creative solutions. This is what I personally think, because we all come from different backgrounds, and when we bring our experience, the varied experience to the table, mm-hmm. we actually have different perspective to the challenge. And from there, we actually develop different solutions. And when that amalgates, that actually it's a very creative process, I think. So I think the international, the working with from people from diverse culture and having diversity in your team is a great thing.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I think that, like, with different cultures, you get different perspectives on things, like you said, and mm-hmm. then you can really, like, solve problems in a efficient way. You don't have to be, you're not thinking one way, you're thinking like five different ways at a time, which is much better and much more efficient to solve a problem. So how did you get interested in working in, like, biochemical engineering and really focusing on sustainability? Because throughout this time, it's like you're so knowledgeable on this. You seem very passionate about it. And I was wondering, like, how did you get into this in the first place?
I would say let me think about this. So I think unknowingly. So maybe put it this way. So I guess my first degree was chemical engineering. I think I mentioned it. Mm-hmm. And then following that, I did biotech, where I apply biological systems for industrial applications. And when I moved into this new field,
mm-hmm.
I must admit it was actually very challenging, because I have not actually done a lot of biology in my, let's say, high school, when I was much younger, in my earlier studies. So when I entered the field, I kind of have to learn a lot of new things. But I also think that it was actually quite amazing, because it was really at a point of time that I see that, oh, actually, nature is really a genius engineer. In a sense, if you think about it, long before we have what solar panels, the plants, algae, bacteria, they are able to actually capture sunlight, use CO2 to actually generate energy for growth. And a lot of our material, whereby we look at water resistant, so water repellent material actually takes a lot of, or draws a lot of inspiration from the design of leaves. So why leaves are water repellent, like the lotus leaf itself, whereby a lot of people actually draw parallel to their material, to nature. And also we talk about fertilizers earlier, how we manufacture fertilizers, but there are nitrogen fixing bacteria in the soil to actually convert nitrogen gas to for the plants to use. So it's actually quite amazing when I think about that. And I think perhaps if you think about these systems that exist in nature, they actually work very harmoniously with our environment compared to a lot of our industrialized process. Mm-hmm. So I think I perhaps didn't realize it then, but I think in retrospect, that was probably the point whereby I developed a lot of interest in using nature-inspired type of engineering to develop and really deliver more sustainable solutions. So I think even right now, I think I still look a lot into what is happening in nature, what exists in nature, to actually use it as a platform for development of different types of technology within my team.
Absolutely. Nature is honestly the best engineer. And it's really, really subtle. Like it's not like overt. We don't always see it, but if we really look carefully for it, we can see like, I know like the golden ratio, I learned that in like fifth grade. And I was just like, how does nature do that?
Yeah, I agree. I think we kind of got used to it because we see it every day. But if you really look deeper, you realize, wow, it's quite amazing.
Yeah. Right, like the hexagons in a beehive. Why? Mm. The snowflake being like a hexagon as well. Like how? And I think if we understand that and really like use what biology is doing and what nature is doing in what we are doing, although they're not very separate, but just like smushing them together more, we'd make some really great things. And I think we're doing that right now.
I think you're right. Yeah.
So I wanted to ask, like, didn't get to ask earlier, but like with, so you said like we're making bioplastics with agricultural waste. Mm. So what kind of agricultural waste? Like how does that work?
Mm. So I actually have a few projects that looks at using different resources to produce bioplastic. So one of it is actually agricultural waste. This is actually one of the project that I collaborate with partners in Thailand. Because Thailand is a huge agricultural country whereby they produce a lot of crops. Mm-hmm. So if you imagine during harvesting, I was very lucky that I actually got to visit one of the processing plant, which is actually processing, let's say, cassava. So cassava is a type of root, and essentially they use the root to produce starch. But in the process, they actually produce a lot of, let's say, the peel, the stem, which actually are not used in the process. So this material can actually be used. They are actually mostly lignocellulosic, and they can actually be used to produce, let's say, bioplastics or even other type of chemicals. And that is where we work together to look at how we can actually use this material on my research partners, they actually looked at how to process them so that they can actually extract and convert them into usable sugars before we actually then use them to produce bioplastic. And the other thing is also in the processing plant itself, because you use quite a lot of water. Mm-hmm. So for example, when you use water, it could be that you have remaining starch in the water. That could also be another way of actually utilizing the waste resources coming from the agricultural industry. Yeah. And I think the other one that is quite common, a lot of people actually looked at it, it's that molasses actually come from the sugar industry. It's a type of a waste material in the sugar industry. And that actually is very rich in sugar. Mm-hmm. And it can also be used for the production of different types of material like bioplastics. I think the type of resource we use, I think it's important to recognize that it has to be catered or delivered according to the needs of different countries. I mean, if you go to a country, I mean, I come from Singapore, there is very little agriculture. So probably that is not the most, I would say that is not the most useful way to see how we can convert agricultural waste into bioplastics. But it doesn't have to be from agricultural waste, for instance, because we have also worked with industries whereby we look at how they can, because there are industries which produce, let's say, they work with lipids and they produce fats from their company. But in the process, they produce a lot of glycerol. Even in the biodiesel industry, they produce a lot of glycerol as a side product. So we have also looked at how to use glycerol, the industrial waste, for the production of bioplastics. And actually right now we are looking at very much into how to convert CO2 in the air into bioplastics. So different types of resources, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great that we're looking at different resources, because you can get like different costs associated with those, like we talked about earlier. But like while we're on like the topic of food in general, like how do you think it's important to be studying bioengineering for food scarcity? Like we don't usually think of bioengineering when we think of food scarcity, but what are your thoughts on that?
I think the food industry is going through quite significant changes in the last decade, I would say. We are really quite stressed from different factors here. One, definitely environment. Environment, because actually if you think of Earth itself, we have very limited arable land. So in terms of producing food, certainly one of the things that has really been highlighted in the last few years, I would say, is probably meat consumption. Because we all, I think many of us know by now that beef, for instance, is one of the protein that actually contributes significantly to carbon emission. Mm-hmm. So following that is lamb. So a lot of the meat that we actually enjoy, because I believe the food industry contributes to about 30% actually of our carbon emission, which is actually quite significant. Yeah, so it is actually a large number. And a lot of people are now actually looking into how to produce alternative protein to circumvent that. So from the environmental perspective, it has been shown that I was in numerous reports that, for example, using alternative protein can actually, or using fermentation to produce protein for making alternative meat, is actually more sustainable in the sense that it uses much less water, it produces much less CO2, and definitely uses less of our land. So it has been seen as actually a route towards an alternative but more sustainable way of producing food. The other thing also is we are a growing population. I mean, right now we are, I think, hitting 8 billion. So it's projected that in 20, I think we will hit 10 billion probably 2050. That's the projection. So if we are already facing the limited land, how are we going to feed everybody as we continue to grow like this? So I think there needs to be an alternative solution. I mean, I think agriculture will be here to stay. I think agriculture will be here to stay. Livestock will be here to stay. It's just that we kind of need to kind of see how we can make them more sustainable, but at the same time, develop an alternative system to complement what we already have, so that we can make sure that it is sustainable in the long run, that we will have our food and nutrition in the long run. So I think that is my view, and I think the industry will continue to develop and grow, and I think it is actually essential that we continue to do that, because we do not want to wait until the time whereby we realize we don't have enough food before we start looking into it. So I think now is really the right time.
Absolutely. It's a pressing issue right now. We have food and water scarcity, so we really need to find ways to overcome that. And we're doing that. So it's just need to continue pushing forward.
I agree. Yeah.
So what, so like switching over to just like some questions I'd like to ask about, you know, diversity and representation of women in STEM. So like, what are women's roles in STEM research and innovation?
I get asked this question a lot, and I actually honestly think that everybody can contribute to STEM and innovation. I mean, STEM research and innovation, whether it's a man, woman. I mean, we talked about diversity earlier, and I think that having diversity is really great, but it is also true that, for example, many engineering departments tend to have less female students. For example, mathematics also tends to have less female students. But I think I actually don't think we have to make everything equal. I think everybody should have the freedom to pursue what they are interested in. And I think maybe some of the things that have been, but I do think that women need role models for them to see that it is possible for them to succeed in the STEM research or STEM innovation area. And I think we have seen now many who are very successful. And I think, well, I guess the only thing I want to say is that they can do as brilliantly. I mean, a woman can do as brilliantly as a male in the research in STEM fields. And I myself have many students who are female engineers. And I visited them in their work environment, and I see how well they are doing. And I spoke to their line managers, and they told me how the contribution they have been making. So I think that we are all equally brilliant. It's just a matter of believing in yourself that you can do it, and just go for it. Just go for it. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think it's important what you said, like, we don't have to have an equal amount of men and women in science or in engineering, but people just should do what they want to do. We shouldn't like force someone to get into STEM just because we need more representation. But like you mentioned, it's also like important that we have women role models that are doing well. And that kind of leads me to my next question. So what advice would you give to younger, possibly underrepresented people who are leaning towards like environmental science or just like environmental engineering?
I think that number one, always, if you think that this is something you're interested in, just believe that you can do it and just go for it. That's first. I think very often people are hesitant because of self-doubt, really, which it's very much about, you know, people talk about imposter syndrome. They wonder if they can really do it. Are they really what they, so, but I think the first thing is having the confidence to actually go for it. The second thing on the more practical front, I think it's very important to speak to other people. So for example, I put myself in this situation. For example, let's say, When I was much younger, to be honest, if you ask me about what's environmental engineering, I probably find it very difficult to tell you when I was 15 years old what exactly environmental engineering is. I think nowadays the school systems are much better, whereby they have a lot of engagement from the industry and from people outside the school to talk more to the students. I think this is very important. So from a for people who are interested in going into this field, I think it is important to engage yourself in, let's say, university activities, mm-hmm. in community activities, to get opportunity to meet people, which allow you to then speak about your interests, for you to understand. It could be that the person is working in a related field, they can tell you more. So I think that is important, not just about getting information and knowledge. That also gives you more opportunities, because it could be that someone you spoke to have an opportunity, for example, maybe sometime down the line in your undergraduate degree, you might want to go for an internship. It could be a possibility there, which helps you to gain more insight into what environmental engineers do. So I think confidence is one. Communicating with others is one. Currently, schools has a lot of programs whereby they actually enable students to do that. So, for example, in our university, we have quite a lot of internships. So this allows you to kind of experience what it is while you are still studying. And also read more. Because actually, if you look into, for example, there are actually associations and societies that looks into different fields. So for example, as a chemical engineer, I'm part of the ICHEME, which is like a chemical engineering society. And that actually, they have their own magazine, they have their own information site, which gives you a broader view of what the field entails. And I think that is helpful to actually just be more aware, just to be more aware about what this, what environmental science is, what type of industry people work in, and also what are the interesting developments that's happened in the field.
Absolutely. I think like just it's important to like believe in yourself, like you mentioned earlier, and just go for it.
Yeah, indeed.
So to close up our really like really interesting conversation about just like biochemistry, how we can use this in the environment, being more sustainable, and like what are some drawbacks, like what's stopping us from being sustainable, I wanted to ask you, like, if anyone wanted to reach out to you, how can they do so? I know I reached out to you in email, so not sure if that's the best way, but
I don't think email is a good way. Of course, I'm also on LinkedIn, so that would be I would say also a good way of reaching out, and these are probably the two most accessible way for everybody. And I do respond to my emails as I do to you and definitely also to some of the comments and feedbacks that I get on the LinkedIn as well.
Wonderful. And just to remind our listeners, we've been speaking to Dr. Kang Lan Ti, and I really want to thank you for your time, for joining me today, and like I mentioned, talking about how we can use environmental engineering to really protect the environment and applying that through your companies. And I've really appreciated talking to you. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Aranya.
And thank you to the listeners for listening.